The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes and Vonnie Quinn. On demand via our Bloomberg Radio Plus app. Free for iPhone and Android devices.
So let us turn our attention now to Joe. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Bonnie. Thanks, Kathleen.
Don't know if you managed to hear Courtney's last story, but the online brokers like E-Trade, Charles Schwab and so forth doing very well because of the idea that the retail investor is getting back in. And, you know, I believe we've seen signs of that. Does it continue, Joe?
You know, I guess a strong market will certainly, you know, dictate more people coming in. So, yeah, I don't know exactly why the stocks are rallying, if it's because of that or other reasons, but it certainly seems like an interesting theory.
Regarding another big topic we'd like to dive right into, and of course this is something that you've written about long before Michael Lewis's book came out about high-frequency trading. You co-authored a book. Now, Barclays, the big British bank, has been charged with basically fraud, not really fully disclosing to its customers what a role they were giving to some of the high frequency traders, the business they were doing with them, the role that dark pools are playing. In your view, Joe, what does it appear Barclays may have done, and how much is it a result of high frequency trading? How much is it a result of a bank trying to build up a business, much as they could have done with mutual funds or any other kind of investment?
Yeah, I think those are good questions. I think what happened, I mean, reading the case, it appears certainly more leaning on marketing fraud to their own clients as opposed to, you know, insider trading or anything like that. So what they were doing, according to the Attorney General, was marketing their dark pool as being clean to a certain extent, use the word clean or non-toxic. And in fact, it, in their own internal documents, it said other things. But I think the real issue here is exactly what you're saying. You know, what were they trying to do? Were they trying to build this dark pool up, and why? And that comes back to the original problem here. You know, dark pools are just kind of a symptom of our equity market structure. The problem is how the equity market structure has evolved over the past, let's say, 15 years to a point where we now have 11 stock exchanges and over 40 dark pools. And when it comes to dark pools, they're very lightly, if at all, regulated in a sense, as a, say, compared to an exchange, which is extremely highly, you know, regulated by the SEC. Dark pools are pretty much private customer flow for brokers or banks. It's their own internal flow. There's not many rules there. So part of our theory or part of our argument is that they should force more disclosure. If someone is trading that much during the day, if dark pools are representing 14% to 16% of the overall volume, you know, we need more disclosure as to what's going on inside these pools. I mean, and I think that's where the Attorney General is going.
And you said they are accounting for how much volume now?
The dark pools themselves are around 14% to 16%. However, off-exchange trading, stocks not trading on the, you know, the listed exchanges, represents close to 40%. And the balance, the difference between the two, is what they call internalization, or those are market makers who are trading order flow off-exchange, whether it's a retail order or others. But there's a lot of stuff that goes on off-exchange nowadays.
There is an argument that dark pools are good, though, right, Joe? And that, you know, they take account of discrepancies between exchanges and so forth and sort of bring everything back into line. So, you know, where do you come down on whether they're a good or a bad sort of addition to trading?
Right, and that's a good question. There are certain, the industry shot themselves in the foot, first of all, by calling them dark pools, right? They used to be known as crossing networks, and, you know, one of the biggest crossing networks that still exists is something called LiquidNet. And LiquidNet, their average trade size is around 40,000 shares. That's a value added to the system. Institutional investors want to cross stock with minimum amounts of leakage. And when you can cross a block of 40,000 shares of a stock that, say, trades 500,000 shares, that's a home run. That's what you want to do as an institutional investor.
Just explain that line, Joe, crossing a stock with a minimum amount of leakage. What does that mean to the layperson?
Sure. So, like, my job during the day, my real job when we're not writing books and talking about this stuff, is to trade for institutional clients. So my clients are hedge funds and mutual funds, and they come to me and they say, hey, Joe, buy 100,000 shares of XYZ today and try not to move the stock. Try not to leak, basically. In other words, don't let these other destinations see you, because the more footprints you leave, the worse it gets, and that's where the predatory behavior starts. So you have to be very careful when you're trading nowadays. And part of the strategy is to go in some of these dark pools and try to get some blocks done. And if, like I was saying before, there are some that are more institutional friendly, let's just call it, and if I can cross 40 of that 100 before I even get going, well, that's a trade that minimizes the leakage so the predators, let's just call them, don't see me coming and then try to jack up the trade or move the price on me. And, you know, some people will say, well, the predators are good because they're actually helping price discovery, and I would argue, no, I'm trying to buy stock. There's a seller out there that wants to sell stock. We just want to meet. But in between, what happens is during the day, the predators come along and sniff, and you end up kind of costing yourself on both sides. So it's a very tricky equation. Trading now has become extremely difficult because of all the fragmentation that's out there. We're kind of trying to glue it back together. That's our goal. You know, we wrote the book called Broken Markets because we do feel it's broken. It needs to be glued back together. Get rid of the unnecessary fragmentation.
So could you walk us through this a bit? When did this change? I mean, I think for most people, they go, well, there's this thing called the New York Stock Exchange. And we know there's a couple other stock exchanges, but the New York Stock Exchange has always been the biggest one and the most visible one. So what was the first step from that world, which isn't so long ago, to the initiation, to the introduction of these pools?
Sure. I mean, if you really want to go back a little bit, 1997 was probably the first step. There was a regulation called ATS, which was Alternative Trading Systems. That's when the SEC was trying to get some of these off-exchange venues. It was a noble cause to get them into the quote, and things kind of derived. They changed along the way. It didn't exactly come out as they expected. But the biggest regulation that really changed everything was 2007. It was Regulation NMS. Again, the Security Exchange Commission, with a noble goal, was trying to do something, and it ended up having these unintended consequences. And just for factual numbers, the New York Stock Exchange prior to Reg NMS was around 80% market share around 2004, 2005. Post-Reg NMS, they're down to around 25% market share, which means if your stock is listed on the New York Stock Exchange, if you're a corporation, only 25% of the trades actually occur on the New York Stock Exchange. The balance occur in these off-exchange venues that we talked about or some of these other 10 exchanges, you know, 11 altogether, 11 being with the New York. So it's so fragmented now, and now everyone's just trying to piece it all back together. It made more sense, we thought, when the liquidity was bucketed. Now, we don't think one venue is the answer, but certainly not 45 and plus 11 exchanges.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, Joe. How would you, suggest fixing this? Because it's not like having one or two exchanges is the answer either.
No, it's not. But some of these exchanges, for instance, of the 11 exchanges, only five of them have market share over 3%. Okay, which means there's a lot of them that could, there's five of them with 3% below. You don't need all of these smaller exchanges. It's just causing this unnecessary fragmentation. The dark pools, 17 of them average over 300 shares on an average daily trade size, which means over 20 of them have, over almost 30 of them for that matter, have average trade size of less than 300 shares. So we would kind of draw a line right there saying, okay, if your exchange can't have at least 3% market share, and if your dark pool can't have at least 300 shares of an average daily trade size, well, then you really shouldn't exist. You shouldn't have the privilege of existing as a market center. However, we do feel that the market should make those decisions, and obviously the regulators, you know, the unintended consequences come along the way. But what you need to do is start cleaning up some of the noise, right? Get rid of some of this fragmentation. Get rid of the payment for order flow, which, you know, maybe we can go on all day about the problems that are inherent in the equity market. But, you know, there are things you can do.
Okay, so, and what is wrong with payment for order flow, and how does that work, and how did that get started? I mean, if you're a broker, you've always, you know, even before electronic trading, everybody took a little piece to make some money, and that's what it's all about.
Sure, well, okay, let's look at this. There's two types of payment for order flow currently in the equity market. One is by the exchanges, which they have a maker-taker model, they call it, where they will pay you to add liquidity, and you pay them if you take liquidity. There's also payment for order flow when it comes to internalization or off-exchange trading of stocks. So in other words, when a retail broker wants to sell his flow to a market maker, and there was a big, you know, they've been talking about Ameritrade lately, and it was in the news where they would make over $200 million, I believe, from this payment for order flow where they're selling it to internalization engines. There are issues here when it comes to price discovery as to, you know, are people sending it to the right spot for best execution? When it comes to internalization, I would argue that if you were trying to sell stock to someone who was bidding in a lit venue, let's just say I'm bidding on the New York Stock Exchange, I want to buy your stock and you're willing to sell it to me, what happens is it gets intercepted by an internalizer or a market maker, and the buyer, so the seller thinks he's getting a price improvement, but the buyer gets a nothing done. There's a problem there. So we don't believe that there should be payment for order flow anywhere in the system. And if you got rid of a lot of that, you would get rid of a lot of the noise and a lot of the movements that, which are caused by economic incentives. And, you know, go back to the Barclays case. One of the things that the Attorney General claimed was they were sending him to venues which weren't advantaging their clients, but it was advantaging Barclays. Well, why is that? You know, follow the money.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So where does the money go? I mean, who is the lobby that would push back against the Joe Saluzzi's of the world saying, hey, this has to be changed, market's fragmented, broken, I can't do trades, it's costing everybody money, it's not efficient. Who pushes back against that?
Well, the industry just does have quite a bit of a lobbyist. I mean, the HFT guys have their own lobby down in D.C. The retail brokers have their own lobby. You know, there's lots of lobbyists, and there's lots of money spent in Washington right now, and we know for a fact that they run around the halls of Congress with reports that are cherry-picked based on cherry-picked data. There are professors that tend to write reports, and a lot of times when some of these academic reports, the first thing I do is I read, see who sponsored it. Oh, and I'll look, and I'll look at this one. This was sponsored by a market maker. Oh, look at this one. It was sponsored by a... First thing you do, and then I'm discounting right away what I'm reading. Okay, but there are lots of people who have a vested interest in the current system, and they want to keep it just the way it is, and they have an argument on their side.
Give me one name, one or two names. Who are those people? Who are those firms?
There's plenty. I won't name them. There are plenty of retail brokers. There's plenty of high-frequency trading firms that want to keep it the same way. There are plenty of big brokers that want to keep it the same way. And they tend to navigate through other groups in Washington. There are lobby groups. There's a group called Third Way that runs reports. There's all sorts of different people out there telling everyone that it's all okay until we have an event, right? But I do think that the new SEC, actually, with Mary Jo White as the commissioner over the last year, has become very aggressive in learning more and seems like they want to make some changes here. So we are encouraged there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what would be your best guess for what kind of changes will happen?
I think the first thing is going to be disclosure. And that really, sometimes people say, well, you're kicking the can, Joe, it's a punt. Well, disclosure means nothing. But no, it means a lot. If you need to disclose where order routing processes are going and what's going inside these dark pools, you start to shine a light on things, and then people have at least a better idea as to where the order flow is going.
Joe Saluzzi, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're very glad to have you, of course. He's partner and co-head of equity trading at Themis Trading, talking to us about dark pools, high-frequency trading, and the cost to the market. We turn next to emerging markets. This is the Hayes Advantage on Bloomberg Radio.
The Hayes Advantage, weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern, in New York on Bloomberg 1130, in Boston on 1200 a.m. and 94.5 FM HD2, or on Sirius XM Satellite Radio Channel 119. Copyright 2014, Bloomberg LP.